And good evening. It is Intuitive Soul Radio with your host, Lori Houston. And this is the second portion of our evening, which is the author portion and Intuitive Soul, Clearing a Path to Divine Consciousness. This evening's guest is Russell Paul, who is the author of Jesus in the Lotus, The Mystical Doorway Between Christianity and Yogic Spirituality. Welcome, Russell.
Thank you, Lori.
So, let us, usually we begin with, you know, what is it that sort of started you on this journey? What sort of got you to where you are now?
I'd say that my journey began around the age of 19. And it was a time when I was questioning my circumstances, trying to make sense of life. And then an accident that hurt a finger that I needed very much to use for playing music kind of disrupted my life, and that moved me into monasticism. And it came through books. My dad had brought me some books from the library. It opened up the world of monastic life to me, and it inspired me to kind of leave my life at that time, which was, you know, going to school and also playing music and opting to live as a monk. And so that was the beginning of this journey.
You say that in your book that we have the call of the beloved, which is, you know, sort of our spirit whispering to us, our heart opening, our intuition. Tell us about, I guess, that experience for you, or how you've seen that unfold.
Well, it kind of began, it's the same period, around the age of 19. It started actually with a sense of, you know, considering death and what kind of meaning life would have for me in the face of death. And this eventually led to that accident I just mentioned. And when I began reading these books on monastic life, it also inspired me to read the Gospels, the New Testament particularly. I'd grown up in a Christian family, but I really didn't feel moved by Christianity itself, at least in its institutional form. And so when I began reading the Gospels, around the same time, something very powerful was taking place internally. I found myself talking to God, and I also found meaning not in any human way. It wasn't like I was picturing a person, but I began speaking to the unknown. And I also began listening, but I don't think it was a deliberate kind of listening. It was simply something that happened. And in the book I describe how I would read passages, just short passages from the Gospel, and then I would find myself going into this curled up, almost fetal-like position, and just waiting like that and listening. At other times, I would look up at the sky, and during those spirits too, there seemed some kind of connection that took place, and often I would just use words, use the words "help me," and there was definitely a sense of communication from some space beyond my self-consciousness that was making me feel something. I couldn't articulate what exactly it was saying to me, but there was definitely a communication, and that communication began to build until it reached that point at which I felt I needed to go leave everything and develop a relationship with whatever it is that was communicating with me.
I guess before we get into the differences between religion and spirituality and Christianity and New Age, let's talk about, you know, what is yoga? Because that is kind of what you talk about, yogic spirituality. A lot of people, when they think of yoga, you know, they're thinking of postures. And if they're lucky, they've included breath work in with the postures. But that's not really what it's all about.
Well, yes and no. I think one way to do it is trace it backwards. The yoga of postures, at least the emphasis on postures and breath work, sort of developed in the Middle Ages. And the text that evolved out of that emphasis is really around the 15th century, what we call the Hatha Yoga Pradipika. And that's kind of the handbook for the strong physical yoga, that strength building. And actually the word, you know, Hatha means, you know, strength in a sense. It actually means, it's got a sort of, in its literal interpretation, it's sort of a little violent. And therefore, I think, you know, we the sense we develop today of this strong power yoga comes from the Middle Ages. But then yoga's roots go back, we, you know, far beyond that. And the next place to look at for the development of yoga is the classical period of yoga, which was at the turn of the millennium with Patanjali, who's sometimes called the father of yoga. And there we find a path called Raja Yoga, which means kingly yoga or the yoga of the mind. And there it is really the mind and the discovery of an inner self that's the key. There's hardly anything about posture. There's only one yoga sutra, and all it says about posture is you have to have a steady and firm and comfortable posture. And it's an eight-limbed path. And posture forms only one of those eight limbs. The rest of it is really developing inner sensitivities, moral and social conscientiousness, and so on and so forth, until there is the sense of union with spirit. And then you go back even further, and we encounter the Bhagavad Gita, which is another classic treatise on yoga, probably around 600, 800 BC. And there we find a very wonderful exposition of yoga, that yoga is union with the divine. It's really have the beatific vision of seeing the divine and knowing the divine in all its glory. And their three paths are extrapolated upon. They are the paths of knowledge, called jnana, the path of devotion, and the path of action. And so right there in the Bhagavad Gita, we already have a sense that before that, meaning in the millennia before that, there must have been a number of different types of yoga, because already we find three types of yoga. And in the Bhagavad Gita, yoga is a generic term. It means union, but it also means the way to that union. And that's how we can look at a whole bunch of different types of yoga being qualified as yoga. And then you look further back and you see yoga was essentially effort, you know, in the what was called the Vedic period. So that's the stretch from, you could say, a desire to gain inner power or mental power or spiritual power to the more refined and devotional forms of yoga and knowledge-based forms of yoga and the Gita, to the classical mental system of Patanjali. And only much, much, much later do we have the strength-building yoga that we are using today, or familiar with today.
So because it's Jesus in the Lotus, I mean, we're talking about Christianity, we're talking about spirituality. Talk about the differences between, you know, religion versus spirituality.
I'd say the main difference would be the set of rules which form the basis of morality and social exchange and personal responsibility. That's like the basis of religion. And the word, you know, comes from the sense of to bind together, relegare, meaning to bind. And people, a culture, you know, find that by living, you know, they have to live together as a people. They're a small group of people or a large group of people living in a specific geographical area. They need a set of rules, certain laws that keep harmony between them, so that people are just not going out and hurting each other all the time. And should they hurt each other, that there's some kind of an accountability. And so religion develops from this, you know, somewhat basic moral standards and social responsibilities that people should feel. Spirituality is something that evolves from out of that. It's a vision beyond the basic laws of living a good life or living a responsible life. It goes into the deepest sentiments that the human is capable of, deep sense of love, we could say unconditional kinds of love, great love, great peace. It looks beyond what is, you know, the basic responsibilities into what can be the most the human can aspire to, the greatest the human can aspire to. And so in, you know, Jesus is one good example because he uses that kind of language, you know, saying, I'm not come to abolish the law, but I've come to, you know, bring this sense of spirit that's beyond, or, you know, curing somebody on the Sabbath as an illustration of what the law is and what spirit represents. And we see the same in the Indian tradition too, that external religion duty, so to speak, is only the first level, but there are these deeper levels of consciousness one can aspire to, and actually the experience of that which births the universe. And that we would, you know, at least from the Indian perspective, this pursuit of consciousness, deeper consciousness, becomes the representation of spirituality.
Mm. And we certainly are moving towards that. Now, I think one of the problems with the word spirituality, and I love how you've, you know, kind of created your own, you know, word about interspirituality, and we'll definitely talk about that. But, you know, I think one of the big problems right now is spirituality is kind of connected with New Age. And I know that you seem to also have concerns in that. Do you want to talk about how somehow that's gotten mixed up, and then we'll talk about, you know, why Christianity is in a crisis?
The New Age movement was an important period because what it allowed was, it allowed for experimentation. I think it came out from this from a puritanical sense, and also a sense of great fear, particularly in Christianity. The New Age movement is really a Western movement.
Yes.
You know, from feeling that you're going to be disloyal if you try something from another tradition, or if you even went to experience another tradition in some way, that you could go to hell. And I think it was an important phase when people began feeling that freedom out of, you know, from the post-60s. There was the sexual revolution, and with that came also the sense that one can experientially explore other traditions. And while that was a very important phase, what also happened was that it became a sort of dilettante type approach, where spirituality became associated with, well, you can do whatever you want. You had complete freedom. There was really no responsibility. But whatever you did went, could be passed off as spirituality. What lacked in the New Age movement was a sense of challenge, which traditional religion, or even true spirituality presents. True spirituality presents freedom, but it also presents challenges to that freedom, to aspire towards the highest growth. And with the New Age, we don't necessarily see a lot of challenges. You know, whatever people create could be passed off as spirituality, and it doesn't have the length or depth of tradition to rely on, and it doesn't have the accountabilities of conventional religion that shape it in any way.
Mm-hmm.
And so while it is very important, we have to recognize that the New Age movement has to evolve, and it is evolving, I'd say, to more credible, respectable spirituality. And so in that sense, the word interspirituality, which actually comes out of the New Age process, but is not limited to it, actually, I wouldn't say comes out of the New Age process. It comes out of it chronologically, but it goes back in time to the viable and well-tested traditions of world spirituality. But it looks to the freedom of the New Age, let's say, of being able to explore more than one tradition. However, it asks that it be done with all of the challenges as well, not just taking those parts that feel comfortable, but also responding to those parts that are challenging.
Yes, and certainly in these times where, you know, we've sort of been taught to kind of hide all of our shadows and hide all of the problems that we are having and not really, not only not deal with them, but, you know, not even acknowledge them. We completely avoid them by, you know, distracting ourselves and getting addicted into, you know, our addictions. And, you know, so it becomes a bit of a challenge for people because there is this movement that, you know, if it's difficult, you know, then it's not meant to be, or some of those phrases that come up.
You're absolutely right. And you brought up some very important words. You know, when we have too much freedom in the name of spirituality, then it does lead to getting into these ruts of addiction, and even qualifying those ruts in giving it some sort of spiritual jargon that almost fortifies it. So we have to be really careful, and you're absolutely right about being very honest about our shadow, our dark sides. And that is both personal and cultural, and also as a species, we've developed shadows that we all share, whoever we are, meaning whatever nationality we are. And so being able to look at this shadow side and seeing how we can bring it into the light, and that is so important for both personal enlightenment, but also, you know, collective enlightenment.
Yeah. So what do you see as the conflict with Christianity, or the crisis that Christianity is in?
Well, there are two sides to it. I'd say on the one hand, you know, Christianity has had some landmark periods of growth, but it's also had a very strong sense of control. And that's both good and bad. That sense of control is what really puts it in the position it is today. It has very clear ideas, but it is willing to change. And I think very recently, was it yesterday or day before yesterday, we see that, you know, the Vatican has invited scientists from around the world to explore extraterrestrial life and the possibility of it. And that's those are the sort of things that always helps us wake up to the fact that, wow, this is very interesting. Or, you know, with Vatican II, the exposure to Assisi, looking at inviting all the different traditions of the world to look at, you know, interfaith dialogue. These are all important landmarks. And so we see, you know, the movement towards openness and learning and so on. But at the same time, the sense of control, and I think the most important thing is that if you stray even a little bit to look at another tradition and what it offers, that is considered a kind of disloyalty to the tradition. Now, I say this especially in Catholicism, but we might see it in some of the other denominations as well. And so that sense of betrayal, and then coupled with the fact that there are problems, just regular problems in life, that comes up for people that the solutions for do not exist, at least not in any viable way. So people, in a way, are forced to look elsewhere from the Christian tradition for answers to their problems. And that has caused this rift. Like in the Catholic Church, some 38% have apparently left from the last Pew Forum last year. Now, that's a large number of people who have left the faith, and many of these people are, you know, we're talking in the West. And so in my looking at it, the one of the most important aspects is, you know, this the mystical dimension. This is one among others, but it's an important fact or condition, let's say, that people have a yearning to have an encounter with the sacred that is not just in human terms alone. And you see, in Christianity, we've developed this relationship with Jesus, and it's very anthropomorphic. And there is a whole group of people for whom that anthropomorphic sense, the purely human connection and human language of describing experience, and also the sense that this is the only way, you know, affects people who have a sense that, no, this is not the only way. And Newsweek, a few months ago, published a very interesting study in which some 68% of Americans do not think in terms of conventional Christianity anymore. They think in terms of a very liberal Christianity. In fact, they almost think in the Eastern way of thinking, where there is a greater universality. Now, the research, in other words, is showing that a great majority of Americans today are actually thinking in terms of a great universality, that everybody is capable of enlightenment, everybody has the opportunity to be saved, there's the possibility of reincarnation as a very real outcome. And so this is astounding in a way of what is happening.
Okay, so you talk about the fact that, you know, Christianity, I guess, as the faith, believes that we betray it if we sort of go towards something else. And so I guess, you know, maybe yoga, when it came in, because it has been so much defined more with the postures and the, you know, again, hopefully the breathing, not all yoga instructors that I've been to have been, you know, as good on the breathing and the mantras as others. So it depends, of course, on where they got their teacher's training and how they did it. So it came in maybe in a non-threatening way, but there are still people that feel prejudiced against yoga, or, you know, that they are somehow betraying their faith if they go into it. And I don't really understand that, but maybe you have a clearer understanding of why that is.
Yes, and that's kind of why, one of the reasons why I wrote the book, because, you know, I do see that, I do encounter that. And it's an important bridge to make before it develops into a deep kind of distrust. Now, originally, when yoga came in, you're absolutely right, and that was a compromise yoga had to make to gain credibility with especially the medical establishment, but also the religious establishment here. And so it had to reduce yoga to this set of postures and as non-threatening as possible, so that it would minimize the kind of resistance that people had, that, you know, this is coming from India, this is kind of Hindu, therefore, you know, you could go to hell if you stand on your head. I myself encountered that sort of a mentality. However, as time has gone by, yoga has gained enormous credibility in the medical establishment. And for the most part, you know, many people who are spiritual, I mean, conventionally Christian, you know, are feeling more comfortable about yoga today and are practicing it. However, saying that, you know, there's nothing that threatens the faith. And while that is true, while that is absolutely true, because yoga doesn't require, no form of yoga requires anybody to choose, let's say, a personal deity or form of God that yoga wants them to choose. In other words, somebody can be a Christian and still be a yogi, because the whole aspiration and methodology doesn't enforce any particular deity on them. But yet, there are, I'd say, many old school Christians who continue to feel that, you know, this is threatening, and people may give up their faith in Jesus, and that they may lose their sense of the dogma that goes with Christianity, because this is a certain universality to the tradition. And I think the greatest fear, and in some ways it's legitimate, is that people would feel very reliant about their enlightenment or their salvation, meaning self-reliant. That is not coming as a gift of God or a grace of God. This is the key thing on which Christianity turns, that salvation is a gift from God. Whereas, you know, in the East, there is that sense that through human effort and the commitment, one can reach into that place of enlightenment, which is the equivalent of salvation. So that's certainly a point of dissension, the fear that people who practice yoga are so self-reliant, and there's a map that leads to enlightenment, that they can have this deep sense of spiritual fulfillment in themselves, and just forget that Jesus had anything to do with it, or that they need God in their lives.
Right. And I guess one of the other things that you mentioned, and certainly I would think Catholicism makes it more kind of obvious, but that, you know, it creates separation between us and God, Christianity, where some of the other faiths from the East, you know, as you say, allow enlightenment, which would be an embodiment of that connection.
Yes, and there are, you know, I describe it later in the book, there are pros and cons to both approaches. Now, while our own capability to achieve enlightenment and the deep realization that my deepest self is divine is a very, very refreshing aspect for many of us who have come out of the Christian construct, because we've had this upbringing of feeling beaten down all the time, that, you know, I'm bad, that Jesus died for me because of my sins and sins of the world, that the only way of salvation is through repentance and asking Jesus for forgiveness and acceptance. That sense of, you know, I am bad, that I'm fundamentally flawed and bad, this is a very, very refreshing point of view, saying I am not fundamentally bad because, you know, I am created in the divine image. In fact, in Christianity, we agree to that, that we were made in the image and likeness of God. Yet that image and likeness is not the foundation from which we operate out of. It's sin that we're taught to operate out of and to make that acknowledgement that we are sinners. And that's why the Eastern view is tremendously refreshing in this wake of negative language. However, there's also the, let's say, flip side of the sense that if we make that connection, at least from the egotistical perspective, and we forget the hard work that it takes to get to that place of enlightenment and knowing ourselves in the image and likeness of God, there's the danger that people in an egotistical, limited way can make that assumption that I am God, I am divine, I am already enlightened, and sort of delude themselves. Right. And so in that sense, see, Christianity has a certain valid point of saying there is that danger. And that's why we have to find a way to look at both traditions and what they offer and respect the challenges that they each offer and respect the assets that they give us. And I think if we were to choose one by itself, the reason why people are leaving Christianity is because they're missing out on this other side that they're yearning for. They are yearning to be told that you are deep down good. You are made in the image and likeness of God. You are, in a sense, already enlightened. You have to remember this. Those are all important things that Christianity has to find a way to let people know. Christianity also has to allow for people to become spiritual adults and confer spiritual adulthood upon them. In other words, to acknowledge them as mystics, encourage the mystical life. So these are the important things. And Christianity raises important social challenges to the Hindu path, where oftentimes the sense that I am God and you are God, and all we have to do is realize that we're God, can sometimes neglect the whole social dimension that Christianity brings, that says, but you know, there's also your neighbor, and when you go and help somebody in need and visit the sick and visit the orphan and you lift somebody up and you stand up for justice, those are very important spiritual things as well, and they are deeply connected with the process of enlightenment, and they bring God into the world, that we have a responsibility to bring the love of God into the world. So that's a very valuable thing that it's not absent in Hinduism. But the point of interspirituality I'm trying to make is that by the emphasis that traditions have had, other things have gone into the background. For 2,000 years, you know, Christianity has stressed the social dimension. The mysticism has been cultivated, but only behind the cloistered walls of the monastery. It's not given to the public over the pulpit. And so, whereas in Hinduism, mysticism is so strong, it's everywhere. But the danger is that, you know, it can lack a strong social dimension. We have a tendency to ignore, maybe forget that our neighbor needs help. And more than that, I have a responsibility to help my neighbor. I am my brother's keeper, kind of sense. And for the most part, we could say that, you know, Hinduism has actually responded very well to that. For instance, the Ramakrishna Mission actually incorporates a very strong social dimension, and I'd say that, you know, it's inspired by, you know, the Christian missionary movement of helping other people in the organization. I mean, it has many similarities structurally and organizationally to Christian missionaries. So we can already see that there's been this cross-cultural fertilization that has taken place because of a Christian presence in India. But we have to change our language. I mean, we can't be in India and telling and taking the point of view that Hindus are all damned and going to hell. And that was very important with my mentor and his predecessors, that they took a different stand that really sought to understand the Hindu tradition and the richness it had to offer and acknowledge that and incorporate it. They were interspiritual in that sense.
Right, and that was going to be my next thought. So, you know, your own interspiritual journey, it started very much as a monastic connection. And, you know, obviously not all of us are going to be able to, you know, take that kind of time and explore that area, although it certainly gave you, you know, a depth of understanding and background in your own beliefs and faith. And I think a lot of times, you know, we come to believe that this journey that we're on is to really hold that center, you know, while we're in the midst of a very populated area or in the middle of a large city, and somehow find that way instead of, you know, what we've done in past lives where, you know, we've been on the mountain and we've we've had that monastery life where. So talk a little bit about your journey and how it sort of helped you. I mean, it just so that people get an understanding of that interspiritual aspect so that they know what that means.
Yes, and that's a very, very good point that you made. You know, not all of us either have the time or feel the call to go live in a monastery. But that's really, I would say, you know, in my own life, I spent 5 years in a monastery, but then I felt the call to come to live an ordinary life in the world. And for the last 20 years, I've been doing that. And what has helped me is the kind of spiritual practice and perspective I developed in the monastery, but learning to apply it in everyday life, learning to apply it in, you know, living a regular, normal, ordinary married life in the world with all its cares and concerns and stresses. And that's really what I share in my work, and I think everybody is called to develop. It's how to develop or cultivate the highest possible mysticism and inner life while living a fully engaged life in the world. That is our challenge today, and actually we have lots of opportunities for that. When we are driving, when we are standing in line at the post office, when we're at a signal light, every moment is an opportunity to cultivate an inner presence and a vibrant spiritual life. We do not have to take time away at all, because everything is giving us the opportunity. And in fact, that is a very vibrant spirituality. Meister Eckhart, the famous Christian mystic, once said, spirituality is not to be learned by flight from the world, but by being in situations and penetrating to the depth there. And that is, I think, the call today, that we have these tools available to us through yoga, through meditation, through Buddhist systems of prayer. All these, we have the freedom to embrace it. But then, how to live our life when we are actually in situations, when somebody cuts us off the road, right then and there we have the opportunity for spiritual practice. And how, and the kinds of resources we draw from in that moment. You know, or somebody tries to, somebody uses very strong language or is abusive to us. Even somebody very close to us, right there is the opportunity. And each tradition offers us something unique. I mean, Christianity would say, forgive this person. And we can take that. And yoga says, here's how you can transmute this energy without repressing it. We can take that too. And I think the two together is what may be for us the future, where we're not just saying, well, I forgive you, but then we also hold a lot of this resentment inside us and push it down. And there's a danger with that. You know, we feel we have to live up as Christians to this thing about, I forgive you. But then how do we process all that energy? And yoga is a fantastic tool which shows us how to process energy in a very visceral way, through the breathing, through the posture, through the muscular contractions. And so there's a great value that the two traditions offer when combined.
Yeah, that's great. We bring up the ego and spiritual discernment. I mean, I guess that's kind of what you're talking about when you have those opportunities, and every moment can be an opportunity. You know, how do we get in touch with those times when we're not necessarily aware quite how much we are in a reactive mode? Or, you know, what is it that we can do to get our ego and to have spiritual discernment?
Yeah, that's the key word, is the awareness. I think a lot of the time we start by being aware after the fact. And that's, let's say, the starting point, being able to be aware after the fact and say, and look back and say, you know, we might say, I wish I had not said it, or I wish I had not reacted in this way, or I wish I had not expressed myself behaviorally in this manner. But the next phase is really being aware while in that situation. And to do that, meditation is a wonderful tool, because we learn to observe without being reactive, meaning observe our own thoughts, our own emotions, without being reactive, without associating or commenting on it. And once we are in that situation and we can be aware, then comes a third phase where we actually make change while we are aware. So those are the three phases. In the beginning, we may not be, we are like Jekyll and Hyde. We go into these situations, we come out, and then we're remorseful that we, you know, we're not our best in those situations. But in order to become aware when it's happening, we, you know, a good healthy meditation practice helps us develop that ability, and then we learn to just be aware. We may not make any changes, but at least we may not be as reactive. We may end up repressing a little bit, but at least we don't express and cause more problems. The third phase is we are able to actually make changes, where we can, you know, we have the self-control, we have the inspiration to say different words. Instead of being reactive, we express ourselves, meaning we are assertive in a certain way, we are clear in our communication, we say what we need to say that puts out how we're feeling, and helps the other person awaken to the fact that, you know, what they're doing is not correct, or it's hurting us in some way, or hurting other people in some way. So in my experience, meditation is an incredible tool, and so is yoga, because especially the breathing techniques that help move energy from one place to another can be very, very powerful in situations where we have to deal with a whole bundle of energy that props up somewhere in our body, be able to have perspective on what's going on in the situation, the actual situation, and then draw from some inner resource that articulates what we need to articulate, where the best outcome for growth becomes possible for ourselves and everybody involved.
Nicely said. You do go into comparisons of the different religions in your book, and, you know, without going through all of that, you have already talked about enlightenment and the mysticism, and we discuss finding union with the divine. Talk about the role of sexuality. I mean, if you're in this world, the Kundalini, and just how does that all fit together? Because if you're living in this world, it's a, should be a part of your life.
Yes, everybody has to deal with it. It doesn't matter whether people have renounced or taken a vow of celibacy, they have to deal with it. And if somebody is in a relationship, they have to deal with it. If somebody is alone, they have to deal with it. Everybody, period, has to deal with it. It's just this natural part, aspect or condition of who we are. And Christianity, I believe, recently I read somebody's review on my book, and this is actually a Christian monk, and he was quoting certain documents in the Vatican that have addressed the issue of sexuality rather well in recent times, and I just haven't read it sufficiently to comment on. I know that, you know, it's certainly a part of the thinking, because in Catholicism particularly, monks have to live, monks and priests both have to live a celibate life. And the way in dealing with it, or how to process sexual energy in my life as a monk. In the 5 years that I spent as a monk, I never had, let's say, methods that came from the Christian tradition that made any sense to me, or even offered a method. Most of it was you surrender it, or you give it up, or you let go it, or you offer it up to God. That was the only language. There was nothing more than that that said how precisely one would go about handling this energy. But yoga, on the other hand, especially the tantric forms of yoga, actually offered methods. And tantra offers methods to both the celibate way and, let's say, an engaged sexuality. It has methods for both options. And that is why it is very valuable, whether somebody's celibate or whether somebody is living a fully engaged life, to be able to have exposure and work with it. I think today with tantra and how it's taught in the West particularly, the association is essentially how to work with sexual energy through sexual engagement. And that is very good in some sense. In some sense, it's also been trivialized and sort of, made an indulgent form of spirituality. So we have to see that side as well. But there is also a Gnostic dimension to the tantric tradition that is very, very valuable in looking at, and many of the methods actually are taken from Hatha Yoga. But there are also additional methods, and there is, let's say, an evolving process in which the West, through psychology and the knowledge of Tantra, is developing an understanding. There is a growing understanding of the chakras and how to develop a viable spiritual tool that takes the methods of Tantra, but also takes certain aspects of the therapeutic process and psychoanalysis, and guides the person into a rich life of energy, in which there is a minimal amount of repression and a maximum amount of energy flow and vibrancy in one's life. But it's not an easy answer. That's what I think I want to say. It's not an easy answer. We're still developing a form in the West. I wouldn't say that the East has figured out this answer either. In some sense, they figured it out, but the method utilized in the East is actually that of being apprenticed to a teacher, and where you kind of live under the direction of a teacher for a long period of time, or a small community. It's not the kind of knowledge that's out there in public for everybody to follow. And what we are developing today in the West is precisely that, a method that everybody can follow, that takes these things into consideration. Is that not an answer?
No, absolutely.
Okay.
I would say, though, if you're going to talk about sexuality, that you would have to talk about Kundalini as well, because then bringing in the East again, but, you know, that movement, because it is that energy that starts that brings the Kundalini.
Yes. In the East, you know, we have this term where the energy that is felt primarily in the genital area is seen to come from somewhere deeper down. This is the kunda, which actually means pit. The word kundal also means coiled. And so in the Eastern way, there is a source for energy that is even deeper than the sexual organ. The sexual organ is the first organ or place where it is experienced, but it is seen as coming from even deeper, from a deep spiritual source, and it's revered as a goddess, the goddess Kundalini. And this actually is just a way of personalizing and personifying energy in order to develop a relationship with energy. And see, this is one thing that we can learn from the East, where we're not objectifying energy so much, nor are we making it subjective too much. We have to find a way to relate to energy as a living component of our life. And that is what the method of Kundalini offers us. It shows us, one way at least, that we can progressively develop a relationship with energy, And how energy manifests in different parts of who we are at different times in our lives. And we see this also in the grand scheme of culture, in the evolution of the human being, and in the evolution of the human, of the universe. We see the same evolutionary stages and energy that lead towards fulfillment. And in that sense, Kundalini Yoga even has a close parallel to Christian eschatology, which says that all of life is moving to a definite fulfillment, that there is a chronological process in which life and human history is moving to a definite fulfillment in God. And so Kundalini says exactly the same thing, that our personal energy has a journey that is moving towards fulfillment. And if once we begin to start understanding that this is energy in motion, and how to be able to guide it, how to be able to participate, how to be in living relationship with it, then we begin to gain a whole different experience of life, and our life experiences begin to take on a new dimension, new color, vibrancy, vitality, and our sense of health, well-being, all begins to be affected by that. So yeah, Kundalini is a very, very important study for us to expose ourselves to. And there's a rich amount of that happening today.
Mm-hmm, definitely. So we're starting to take this journey inward. We're starting to chart this path. You talk about self-discipline of our spiritual practices, and we've talked about meditation, we've talked about yoga. You also talk about fasting and prayer. And do you want to go into any of that? Is that... Or what your self-discipline is, or what you feel that we sort of need?
Well, prayer, for me, prayer and meditation are both important. And the difference, for me at least, is that prayer is communion with the divine, and it's conversation with the divine. It sets up a two-way relationship where, you know, we're communicating with the divine, and we're allowing the divine to communicate to us. Meditation, on the other hand, allows that duality, that God and I are separate, I'm talking to God or God is talking to me, to dissolve, so that there's a purity about the relationship and the union. And for me, that's very important too, that we let go of all the ideas, the conversation, the expectation, even the listening to some degree, and move towards this state of union, where there's pure presence, we could say, or God is in a way that is indisputable. That God is not a construct of the mind. We're not imagining God present. We're not affirming that God is present, but we're truly experiencing that the divine is present. And so that cultivation every day, that remains very much a part of my practice. I was inspired by my mentor even in his late 80s, and despite his deep holiness and connection to the divine, he never failed to meditate twice a day, in the morning and in the evening. And I continue that practice at least a minimum of 20 minutes and usually a half an hour. So somewhere between 20 and 30 minutes every morning and every evening, I spend time. It is a dedicated time, it's a discipline, of course, of meditation. But then apart from that, we need to have a variety of possibilities that keep us engaged. And for me, I try to find a way so that it doesn't let up, where every opportunity, sitting in front of a computer, taking a walk, they're all reminders of, and this is what the monastic life offered me. Because that's what you do, you know, from the time you wake up to the time you go to sleep, you try to keep the awareness of the divine presence alive and feed that in the best way you can. You use scripture if you can, you use anything, mystical poetry, you use breath work, whatever is available to you at that moment, to keep alive and deepen and nurture one's sense of connection. And if one is with people, then, you know, to sense it in people and to cultivate, and that's not easy. I mean, it's easier to sense the divine in nature than it is with people, especially if when people reveal their dark egotistical side. But that is the challenge for us, that despite people revealing that side, or us sensing that side in people, how can we sustain the sense of presence in ourselves, because it is that that also helps the other person be aware that there's something in them that is beyond their ego. And so that's the challenge. It's not easy. I'm not always successful at it. But the commitment, that's the discipline, every morning until the night, to have this curiosity, never to take it for granted that I know everything about God, or to keep a certain freshness alive, to look for those moments where maybe there is a stronger presence in a certain spaces. We may walk into a church, or we may walk into a park and find that it's poignant, or with a sense of presence, a spiritual presence in that place. There's no need to know why, but just to tap into that, recognize it, and then hold that space for a period of time. If we're always thinking, always preoccupied with what is going on in our mind, then we fail to connect to those. And that's why meditation is a powerful tool, because it's a way of being able to sense what is happening outside of the stuff that's going on in our minds. And that's the key thing in yoga. Yoga, the very first aphorism is, yoga citta vritti nirodha. It's the cessation of movement in the mind. And why? And Patanjali says, tada drishtu svarupe avasthanam, which means then the self shines in its own glory. We know when we stop in getting involved with the content of our mind, we sense something else. We sense that which is the one that is perceiving, is witnessing. There's a spiritual presence that we sense. If we don't do that, he explains in his next sutra, vritti sarupyam itaratra, at other times, our sense of self is so bound up and so confused with what is happening in our mind that becomes our sense of self, the content of our mind. And just those few statements, gives us a sense of the power of yoga and what it really does. And that's what yoga is truly about. You asked me that question in the beginning. It's about knowing and having a direct encounter of spiritual presence inside us and around us, but primarily inside us. It's the discovery of spiritual presence inside us. And the way to that is getting the mind out of the way. Because that's the key obstacle. And Eckhart Tolle put it very beautifully. He said, it's become a disease. You don't even realize it. We don't know how to get the mind to stop thinking. But more importantly, we do not know how to stop looking at what the mind is thinking about. If only we could learn to sense what is there, despite the mind doing its thing. That's very powerful. We have to learn both. We have to learn to still the mind. We also have to learn to sense what is going on. It's just not all life and consciousness. It's just not this stuff that's circulating in our mind. And that's a question I ask myself many times a day, and it helps me. I ask the simple question, what are you looking at? And if I'm just looking at the thoughts and images in my mind, I realize that there's so much more than what's going on there. And that's an opportunity to shift one's ability to sense what is apart from what is going on in one's mind.
You talk about spiritual intimacy and how, we need to surrender our will, and that it needs to really be a heartfelt surrender. But how do we do this? I mean, this talks about, the deconstruction of our ego versus, denying our ego. And you also touch on the dark night of the soul. And there's so much depth and richness that I'd love to still get into. But of course, we're running out of time. But, how do we start to understand or become aware enough to surrender that will? And what does that look like?
Well, A good phrase to take is from the Bhagavad Gita, which says, yoga is renunciation, but you cannot really discover renunciation until you renounce the formative will, sankalpa. It's a very interesting word, you know, and the Hindus have struggled with this, and they've got this deep insight. It's this formative will, the will that strategizes and schemes, and it's kind of almost cunning. It wants to work things out, but through manipulation. And that is the will that we surrender. The desire to manipulate the circumstances, especially in meditation. We learn it primarily in meditation. We learn how to give up the desire and the power to manipulate. And when we do that, we learn to surrender that capacity in something. We may choose a phrase, like a mantra, and this is both in the East and West. People use the name of Jesus, or they say, God, come to help me, or Maranatha, an Aramaic word which means the Lord is coming. That sense that there's a vehicle for the will to surrender. We have to have a vehicle for the surrender. And so it could be a phrase, or it could just be the breath itself. Onesiphorus, who was a Christian monk in the 12th century, he put it beautifully. He would say, in fact, very yogic in his methodology. He'd say, you know, my brother, he's talking, of course, to his other male monks, my brother, you know how the breath moves in and out, so you constrain yourself to rest in that breath and keep your presence there. So 800 years ago, you know, we had this interesting connection to yoga. We have to have a vehicle to surrender the will. Once we have a vehicle, once we learn the principle of surrendering the will, then we can even let go of the vehicle. We don't need the mantra, we don't need the breath. It can even be a movement, like, you know, the twirling dervishes, the Sufi dervishes. You can just hold your hands up and move around. Something that's cyclical, and that's something that's happening continually, gives us the opportunity, because it's a repeated surrender. It's not just something we can do once and for all. It's moment to moment to moment. It's a series of moments. We are continually surrendering it. But, you know, the will is impetuous, as is the mind, and it's going to start thinking, and it's going to want to wander away. And so it is the connection we have and a desire to be connected to the divine or some deep unknown source in us. It's a passion for the invisible, I'd say, that gives us the inspiration to continually surrender the will. And that surrender of will opens up, let's say, a dimension within us, an actual pulse within us in which we can experience a sense of communion with spirit. But it's, you know, it's practice. You know, when you find the mind wandering away, you bring it back to that simple process of surrender. The Buddhists have a beautiful phrase. They say it's a developing mind muscle.
And you also talk about, you know, that it takes trust to turn on that passionately seek this connection, because we feel that passion within.
Yes, very much so. And you know, it comes in phases. You know, when we have a curiosity about the divine, it opens up, and we have to keep that curiosity alive. You know, to really want to know God as God is, or want to know the divine as the divine is, not so much by what people are telling us, not even so much by what the scriptures are telling us, because those are other people's experiences. As we develop a passion to know the divine in a way that we can, not just going by what other people have experienced, and we begin to apply. I mean, it's what we do in any relationship. We want to know somebody. And we put ourselves out. We create opportunities to meet them. We create opportunities for them to get to know us. We talk to them. We let them talk to us. We find out their tastes. We do things about that. We buy them gifts. It's very much like that with the divine. It's the things we do and are willing to do and the extent we're willing to go. I mean, what an extent we would go if we have a deep desire to love somebody. I mean, I'd use that as an analogy in the book. You know, we'd go through elaborate scenarios, you know, to create the ideal conditions, all for what? For those moments of exchange, you know, looking into the other person's eyes or holding their hands or having a deep lovemaking experience, whatever it is, is only that itself is only for a short period of time, but what about all the preparation that goes into that? And so in our relationship with the divine, one thing it's very useful to ask ourselves is, what are we doing about it? What are the little things we're doing about it? And what are the great extents? What are the hoops we're willing to jump to communicate? And we're really communicating to ourselves as well, that this is how much I have an interest, a love interest in the invisible.
Well, Russell Paul, you are a delight. I think your wealth of knowledge is incredible. I think, you know, this book, Jesus in the Lotus, will help a lot of people to maybe weave that bridge between Christianity and interspirituality and yoga. Tell people how they can get a hold of you and your book.
It's through my website, primarily for myself, meaning if people want to communicate with me or read articles and so on. It's Russell Paul, RussellPaul.com, and my email address is on that. The book itself is, I guess, available on the internet and in stores, but it's also available on my site.
Well, thank you very much. This has been a very enjoyable interview, and talking about these concepts has been very inspiring.
Thank you, Laurie. Thank you for having me.